So as Lynn said, I'll be talking about the Four Noble Truths for the next 4 weeks. But I would like to introduce myself just briefly. I've been practicing mindfulness meditation for about 7 years. And the large part of my practice, the last 6 years, I've spent in intensive retreat. In some years, I've spent 6 months or more on retreat. And recently, I returned from Burma, where I spent 4 months in a monastery. So that's where the bulk of my practice has been. But I also began my practice with a very extensive daily life practice, because I kind of went in through this door of suffering. So I'll tell some stories about that too. So this is, I'm going to make this kind of like a class as opposed to just a series of talks. And so I'm going to have it have a maybe a slightly different format than some of these other Thursday evenings. I'm going to include some talking, some maybe even some reading from the suttas, if it doesn't put you to sleep too much. and some discussion, some reflection, as well as some meditation practice. The Buddha actually taught that there are three ways to develop wisdom, and those are through listening, reflection, and developing meditation. So I wanted to include all of those in this class. So I'll start by just giving an overview of what the Four Noble Truths are, just in case some of you haven't heard of them. I'm sure many of you have. But in the first discourse the Buddha gave after he was enlightened, he laid out for his five disciples that he spoke to, he laid out the core of his teachings, which were the Four Noble Truths, and they are: there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's an end to suffering, and there's a path to realizing the end to suffering. Now that may sound like a kind of a downer. but over my time in practice, I've begun to realize and really experience the joy of seeing the Four Noble Truths in my practice and in my life. So I hope to convey that and to give you some of the experience of that as well during these 4 weeks. In the discourse, in that first discourse, the Buddha not only laid out those four truths, but he also told his disciples there are actions associated with each of those truths. They're not simply meant to be believed as religious dogma, but they're meant to be practiced with, acted on. And the actions associated with each of them is: the truth of suffering is meant to be understood. The truth of the origin of suffering is meant to be abandoned. The truth of the cessation of suffering is meant to be realized, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering is to be developed. So this, to me, this shows the very practical nature of the Buddhist teachings. At its core, Buddhism is a practice, not a dogma. It's not something to believe, it's something to live in your life. In fact, the Buddha kind of gives an amusing simile for someone who looks for answers to metaphysical questions. Because essentially, these are not metaphysical statements, and Buddhism isn't really about metaphysical beliefs. And he gives an analogy for someone who is looking for answers to metaphysical questions someone who's looking for answers to metaphysical questions as a path to the holy life. He says it's like someone who has been shot with an arrow and in great pain, lying on a bed surrounded by his family and in great suffering, and the family, all concerned, calls the doctor to have the doctor help this man with an arrow in him. And when the doctor comes, the man says, "Before you take this arrow out, I want to know what the name and clan of the man who shot the arrow were. I want to know what type of material the bow and shaft were made of. I want to know what the spear was made of." And the Buddha says, by the time the man finds the answers to all of these questions, he will have died. So the Buddha says, let's look at the suffering. Let's look at the end of suffering. That's the core. That's the place where we can live our spiritual life and where we can wake up. In fact, the Buddha is sometimes quoted as saying, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. And when I first heard that, I thought, that's two things. In fact, I checked, and some of the translations actually do say, I teach two things. But in my practice, I've begun to see that there's a way in which saying, I teach one thing, suffering in its end, that's a teaching itself, because I've begun to see that with really looking at suffering, understanding it as the Buddha suggests that we do, with really understanding suffering, you see the end of suffering. It's kind of a natural unfolding that through really, truly, deeply understanding suffering, suffering ends. And so to me, they are one thing. If you see suffering truly, deeply, clearly, you also see the end of suffering. So that's an exploration in my own practice, and one that perhaps you can bring into your own as well. So during the course of the 4 weeks, we'll explore each of the four truths and the action associated with each of them. So tonight we'll start with the truth of suffering, or dukkha is the Pali, the truth of dukkha, and understanding dukkha. So dukkha, the word dukkha in Pali, is usually translated into English as suffering. And life is suffering is how some read or take or hear the first noble truth. And some people hearing that just reject Buddhism out of hand because there's so many parts of life that don't seem to be suffering. But the meaning of dukkha in the Buddhist sense, in the sense of the first noble truth, is much broader and deeper than what we usually attribute to the term suffering. Some have given it different translations, and I like some of these translations. I like thinking about these other words because it helps me see the breadth and the depth of the term. So unease, dissatisfaction, stress, those are other translations that people have used for dukkha. Maybe fewer people would quarrel with the statement, dissatisfaction is a truth of life. It seems like even when our lives are going well, there's always some way that we're dissatisfied. We want a bigger car, a better body, a different job, more money, whatever. We just want something to be different. One thing that you'll see in Buddhism is that there are many lists. There are lists of just about everything. And the Buddha was a great analyzer and categorizer, so I'll use some of his categories in these few weeks. The Buddha said that there are basically three types of dukkha. So all the dukkha that we have, he kind of puts into these three categories. And they're the suffering due to pain, the suffering due to change, and what I'll call the suffering due to existence. The suffering due to pain, I like the name of this in Pali. It's called dukkha-dukkha. As if you didn't get it the first time, really get it the second. This is the kind of suffering that we're all familiar with. We don't miss the fact that we're suffering when we're in dukkha-dukkha. But I want to pause here for just a moment and point out that when the Buddha talks about dukkha, he's not talking about the actual physical pain or the unpleasantness, the unpleasant sensation, not talking about the unpleasant mental feelings or physical sensations. What he's talking about, what he's describing, is the reaction to the pain, it's the reaction to the pain that causes our dukkha. The reaction is, this shouldn't be happening. I don't like this. I want this to go away. Actually, dukkha is created by the mind. It's not a physical thing. So this is maybe a little hard to understand, but the pain itself is just a physical sensation. It's just a sensation. It's just an unpleasant sensation. It may be a very unpleasant sensation. But what happens when we experience an unpleasant sensation is that our bodies and mind contract around it. We react to it. We don't like it. So say I've got a pain in my back. I get tense. I get tense around that pain, and that actually increases the pain. So the reaction increases the suffering. And it actually is the suffering. The reaction is the suffering. And that's an exploration that you go through over and over again in looking at this to see, again, how am I reacting to this? How am I reacting to this? So there's a physical reaction to pain. But maybe more commonly, if we have some kind of an unpleasant sensation, there's an emotional reaction to it, where we get ourselves wound up in the situation. So say you have a cold or something, just a little runny nose, a headache, maybe a slight fever, and you have a big presentation to do the next day. The mind won't just stay with the sensations as they are. The mind goes into the story about, oh, I'm going to be too sick to do this presentation. What am I going to do? Am I going to have to call my boss and tell him I can't come? Or am I going to just have to, you know, talk it out with this sore throat? Or, oh, what am I going to do? Oh, maybe it's SARS. Oh, no. Maybe, oh, how could I have gotten SARS? And, you know, the mind will just go off into an amazing story. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't consider our actions and the consequences of them. I mean, if you have a cold, you need to take care of yourself. And but in all likelihood, the thoughts that are arising aren't calm and careful consideration about the situation. They're more likely a very strong emotional reaction, and you can feel that in your body. We believe our emotional reactions, and we suffer because of them. If we simply attended to the physical sensations of a cold, we might find maybe a pressure, an unpleasant pressure in the head, a heat in the body, a feeling of wetness in the nose, a scratchiness in the throat. Maybe the body doesn't feel like getting out of bed. When I've actually been able to be with the physical sensations of an illness like that, a mild cold, not a major illness, but a mild illness, I found actually there are pleasant sensations along with the unpleasant. It's actually, there's a kind of a relaxation in the body when I have a cold that feels pretty good to lie there in bed. So if we can just be with the physical sensations without the reaction, life becomes much simpler. In deep states of meditation, you can also see pain in a very different way. If you're in meditation and the knee begins to hurt, you can let your mind rest right on the sensations of the pain, and it begins to have a very different quality. It's just a sparking movement. It's like this dance of sensations, and it doesn't actually... In certain states, it's just unpleasant sensation. There's absolutely no reaction to it. And it doesn't have any quality that we normally associate with pain. And that's where you begin to really see that the dukkha is created by the mind. The suffering is created by the mind. That the suffering isn't actually in the sensations. Without the reaction to the pain, it really loses its quality of pain. It's very interesting. The second type of dukkha is the dukkha due to change. And this refers to the suffering that we experience when something pleasant ends. So even when things are going well in our lives, it can only take an instant for things to change very dramatically. It could be an accident, a death in the family, a diagnosis of cancer, and suddenly our lives are just completely disrupted. And we can't control the circumstances of our lives, and this is part of this suffering due to change, that inability to control. We want control, we want the illusion of a security in our lives, and when that's presented to us as being an illusion, we get very disturbed, our minds get very unsettled. So when we feel like we're secure and something happens to point out, oh, that's not the case, I'm not so secure, we really suffer. But the suffering due to change isn't just referring to the kind of dramatic suffering that you might get in a major life upset. It also has many gradations, and this you can look at also in your own lives. We can experience the pain of a loss when a loved one leaves us, when a relationship breaks up. We can experience that pain of loss if they just go on a business trip. We can experience suffering if something we treasure gets broken, a favorite mug or a favorite vase. If something, if a period of joy and happiness in our life ends, sometimes we feel like we've done something wrong, that we failed somehow. Again, the suffering due to change results from a reaction to the change. It's not inherent in the change itself. We think when things are going well that this is the way it should be. We believe that this is right. There's a kind of a crystallization of, yes, this is right, this feels good. And when that falls apart, we suffer, not so much because of the change, but because that crystallization of, yes, this is right, has broken apart. So when things change, we kind of take it personally. We think, oh, why me? Why me? A kind of a silly example maybe can help explain this came from an experience I had when I was on retreat. I was doing my morning work meditation, which was peeling vegetables in this case. And we were peeling beets that day. And I was experiencing a feeling of despair. And in an interview with my teacher, Joseph Goldstein, a few days earlier, he had reminded me that all experience is a possible source of insight. And so remembering that, I just said, okay, well, despair is where I am. It's what I'm experiencing. What is this? What's happening? And so I just began paying attention to what was going on in my body, in my mind, in my experience. And I noticed in peeling the beets that there's a really interesting pattern on the beets as I was peeling them. And there was a recollection in my mind of several weeks earlier when I had been peeling beets and seeing that pattern and experiencing great joy in seeing that pattern. And what I was in despair about was that I was not experiencing the joy I had experienced 2 weeks before. I was in despair over beets. And when I realized this, I just like burst into laughter. And my whole landscape of experience changed. So that it became very clear to me that my suffering was due to what I was expecting. There was that pleasantness, that wonderful joy that had happened earlier, and there was an expectation that it should be there. And when it wasn't, there was that suffering of despair. So we could maybe say suffering is hidden in pleasant experience. I kind of think of it like the yin and yang thing, where the seed of light is in dark and the seed of dark is in light. That's how I kind of think of the suffering of pain and the suffering of change. The third type of dukkha is the suffering due to existence. And this maybe could perhaps be called the Buddhist version of existential anxiety. And it includes the most subtle forms of unease. And this is a hard one to describe, and you know, the clearest look at this kind of dukkha is seen in very deep states of meditation. But you can see it in your life when things are kind of neutral. If experience is neutral, what's happening? What happens to the mind? Does it get bored? Does it feel vaguely dissatisfied? Or maybe construct a fear or a fantasy? We're actually addicted to the highs and lows of life. We crystallize ourselves around both the highs and the lows. We tend to prefer the highs, but if we're honest with ourselves, we also are kind of addicted to the lows as well. As long as there's something happening, we're able to say, yes, this is me, this is who I am, this is how I react. And if we don't have that, if there's very neutral, we get kind of feeling of what's happening, what's the meaning of things, what's going on. And that's a very uncomfortable feeling. So I'll have more to say about dukkha, and particularly about the understanding piece of it. But right now I'd like to stop for a few minutes and do a reflective meditation on dukkha. So I was taught this reflective meditation by Ajahn Amaro, and the way he describes it is to basically get yourself into a very quiet place. And from that place of stillness and quiet, let the question come into the mind, or let the idea that you want to reflect on come into the mind, and then don't think about it directly, but just see what arises. See what happens in the body, see what happens in the mind. Don't necessarily follow the thoughts, but remember them. If a thought comes up, remember it. If certain bodily sensations come up, remember them, and then kind of just go back to the stillness, if possible, and just sit with the idea again. And we can learn a lot about how we feel about something by not actively thinking about it, but by kind of seeing what bubbles up from the depths. So we're gonna maybe sit quietly for about 5 minutes or so, and then I'm going to suggest a few topics for you. Maybe one a minute for you to just sit with. So I'll just kind of drop the word into your meditation and hope that we'll see what happens. an ease. Dissatisfaction. How do I suffer? So I'm curious if anybody would like to share any of the reflection with the group. Is there anyone who had anything they'd like to mention?
This isn't sharing, but what were the first two words? I just didn't get them.
Oh, I'm sorry. Unease.
Unease.
And dissatisfaction.
teariness and an awareness of tension in the back. It seemed to be something that I couldn't, wasn't in front of me. It wasn't something that was definitely behind. And dissatisfaction, I noticed, made me feel was in my stomach more, and it made me kind of feel pouty. And how I suffer, kind of, I got lost with it. I couldn't quite. I thought, in sort of the words of Shakespeare, let me count the ways.
Thank you, Lewis. Yeah, Dan.
I heard disease or unease.
Oh. Disease can be used too.
And it triggered a feeling of panickiness welling up in me. Something imminent was about to happen.
I missed the first word entirely. I was so busy concentrating on my breathing. And then when you said the second word, it kind of registered. And then when you said, how do you suffer, I had this instantaneous knee-jerk reaction, which was, how don't I?
Interesting.
So, it was just everything was going, and until you asked that question. And then I had to, pull myself almost physically back into my breath.
Interesting. Thank you.
The thing that caught me most was, how do I suffer? About that which isn't there, the unknown, I worry about a lot. But the dissatisfaction, I'm a bit of a perfectionist. You said that what came to mind is what good there is in it, for some reason.
What good there is in it.
Yes, because I'm always, or not I, but we're dissatisfied, like myself. But I look for the good in things now.
I see.
What there is of it is okay, or how it can be resolved ultimately if it needs to be. And it's a twist of the way I've been looking at things the last almost 60 years.
Any other comments or questions about what I said earlier? Any? Yeah, Paula.
When you were talking about how when something is going well or you have a pleasurable experience, you crystallize around it and you think this is the way things are supposed to be. Well, I realized that that is a great cause of suffering for me. Because, today I got to be with someone I hadn't seen for a long time. And it was a very pleasurable experience. But when it was over, I could tell that I was kind of reaching out and I felt sad that it was over. And dissatisfaction because it wasn't going to continue.
Thank you. That's the way it is. It really is. It's what we have to look at.
It's a very oppressive nature of experience.
Yeah, Jim.
Yeah, well, I wasn't able to sit still through the whole. I mean, listening to you say those words, it kind of went from unease, which is just kind of a general sense of physical discomfort, to when you got to dissatisfaction, it became more intense. And by how do I suffer, it was like, who's she asking that? I came for the answer. So it was pretty amazing. I mean, it was what started feeling like I was sitting with a modicum of discomfort that I could sort of easily ignore to doing the reflection. It just like it just made it more and more obvious to me. And
That's actually true, you know, that suffering does become more obvious to us as we do this practice. It's kind of a it can be difficult at times, but that is definitely true. But there's a good side to it, actually, which we'll hopefully get to also. Ellen?
I was really struck by one of the things that you said early on, or earlier, was about this neutral state, and how that often the highs and the lows are what we crave. And I have a friend who have kind of a tumultuous relationship with, but I will call. And I think there's something attractive about this relationship because it allows me to see who I am, and I don't know why, and just in analyzing why I'm attracted, is that, and there are those highs and those lows, and I get very irritated. But I think it's some of that feeling alive or feeling, it's something to rub up against that you realize yourself or whatever it is. But I feel like I'm much better off when I don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting place to pay attention to then. You know, that place of feeling a little more
even keel,
or peaceful, or maybe even just, maybe even slightly bored. See if that's when you pick up the phone. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah.
See, you mentioned the three dukkhas, and you said the first one was dukkha.
Uh-huh.
What are the...
The Pali names of the other two? Viparinama dukkha is the dukkha of change. And there's also a Viparinama sukha, which is the happiness of change. That's the happiness when something unpleasant ends. So there's Viparinama dukkha and Viparinama sukha. And then the third type of dukkha is Sankara dukkha, which is the technical translation of Sankara is formations or... I guess formations is probably as good as any. Mental formate, just things happening, things forming. The suffering of things forming. Okay, well, I'll talk a little more about understanding dukkha, which I think is really where the core of the practice is in the First Noble Truth. So the Buddha enjoined us to understand suffering. So what does that mean? In his discourse, in his first discourse, he actually broke, when he described the Four Noble Truths, he actually broke each of the Four Noble Truths down into three things. So the first one, the three things we're supposed to see about suffering is, this is suffering. The second one is, suffering should be understood. And the third one is, suffering has been understood. So the first thing about suffering is that we need to see that we're suffering. We need to actually recognize it as suffering. So often we're caught up in the content of what's happening that we don't even see that we're suffering. One time I was, at one point early in my practice, I was experiencing a lot of anger. And I believed somehow, I believed somehow that my anger would somehow hurt the person I was angry with. There was that belief that my anger would somehow make him suffer. And it was pretty clear, actually, because I happened to be 7,000 miles away in the South Pacific and he was here in California, that my anger was not doing a thing to him. but it was really burning me up. So I began to see that that anger was suffering and that it was me that was suffering. And that was a really kind of a crucial recognition. So that was the seeing. Yes, this is suffering. It's a recognition, you know, not to be caught in the content of why I'm angry, but yes, this is anger and this is unpleasant, this is suffering. So mindfulness helps us to disentangle from the content of our experience so that we can be with it more simply, and it can help see how we're contributing to the suffering, to the distress that we're feeling. So when we do see that we're suffering, the second part is to recognize that it's actually valuable to understand it, to look at it. So that's actually part of the insight, is seeing, oh yes, I should look at this. It's worth paying attention to this. There's a wonderful poem that by Rumi that kind of celebrates this this recognition that suffering should be understood. It's called The Guest House. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. This understanding of suffering that the Buddha refers to primarily means knowing the distress, knowing the suffering through direct experience, rather than through thought, through conceptualizing about it. It doesn't mean trying to figure it out. Through a non-judging mindfulness, we can actually know the actual experience of pain or loneliness or anger in this very moment. And a good way to be with a distressing situation is to be with it in the body. So if there's physical pain, you can be with it in the body. Just, you can try this maybe sometime during the week, not maybe with the most severe physical thing that you've experienced, but if you stub your toe or hit your elbow or something, see if you can just feel what the body is experiencing, the pulsing, the vibration. Just try to be with the actual physical sensation of the pain rather than getting caught in the how could I be so dumb to walk into the table, or you're just, oh, there's that pain, there's a sensation. What is that sensation? So just be in the body with the experience. You can also be in the body with strong emotions, with anger or loneliness or frustration. You can see what the reaction is in the body. Just if you feel the anger, just see what's happening in the body. Is there a contraction in the stomach, a tightness, a feeling of energy moving outward? What's happening in the body with anger, with loneliness, a feeling of heaviness, of lethargy? Just what's going on? So you can help to get into or get out of the story by connecting with the body. But you can also, it can help also when you're suffering to notice moods, images, thoughts that might be coming up. If we can see those things without following them, if you can see a mood without getting hooked into it and thinking about it, if you can see a thought and just say, oh, there's a thought about my bumping into the table, and not get hooked into it. That can be challenging, but just see what happens during the week. Just try it a few times. It might be, we might have to take it on faith at first that it's really worth understanding dukkha. Because it, as Jim said, you know, you get to see it more and it becomes more obvious. And it's like, why am I doing this? It's becoming more unpleasant. But over time, it is kind, I mean, it is kind of unpleasant to spend time in the space of suffering, but over time you begin to see that it's the type of suffering that ends suffering. It's not contributing to our further suffering. It actually will help us to end suffering. We see that, we begin to see that we're actually suffering less when we're directly with the suffering. And as we begin to experience these things, it kind of snowballs. It feeds itself. There becomes a kind of a verified sense of, yes, this is worth it. Yes, I see I should understand suffering. This is something I want to do. And when we do experience that understanding, the full understanding of suffering, we see that it does begin to end. That's the third one. Yes, suffering has been understood. Yes, I understand how that suffering happened. So I'll tell you a story. This was a kind of a clear instance for me. Again, this was pretty early in my practice. It was after the breakup of a 10-year relationship. And I often noticed sadness when I went to bed at night. And I assumed that the sadness was because, oh, I'm single, I'm alone, you know, that kind of, I figured it was some whole complex of emotion that was going on. But I was trying my mindfulness, so I began just paying attention at night. When did I begin to be lonely? You know, just kind of, as I was going to bed, where is the loneliness? And I began to see that it started when I set my alarm clock. And I continued to just simply watch each night, you know, it's like, wow, what, setting my alarm clock, that's interesting. And one night, as I was setting the alarm clock, I saw an image in my mind. A memory had arisen in my mind. And I was with my ex-boyfriend in Disneyland looking up at the marquee in Tomorrowland where there was a digital clock. And I was setting a digital clock. And so I could see that the memory was arising from the sense impression of the clock I had in my hand. And I could see that my loneliness was a reaction to that memory. And I was amazed, actually, that this was pretty early in my mindfulness practice. And I was like, wow, you know, this mindfulness can help me see where the source, what's the source of this loneliness. It was really mind-blowing. But the actual bigger mind-blowing thing was the next night when I went to set my alarm clock, I didn't get lonely. And that was, I see, you know, now in retrospect, I didn't look at it through the, you know, First Noble Truth at that point. But, you know, looking back at it, I could see that I saw that I was suffering. I saw that I should understand it. And when I had understood it, it went away. It disappeared. It no longer came back. That particular loneliness. I'm not saying that I was never lonely again, but just that kind of regular, you know, every evening setting the alarm clock, getting lonely, that went away. But we can't expect all of our suffering to disappear that easily. We sometimes need to be compassionate with ourselves about what our boundaries are. How much suffering can we actually be with? And sometimes we have to just live with something for months, years even, and just be with it. Another story about anger, and this was the same breakup of the relationship. And when I was extremely angry with him, I thought I had really been mistreated. But since I was into the mindfulness, what I had decided to do at that point was to use the anger as a mindfulness bell. So when I got angry, I kind of set the intention, okay, when I get angry, I'm going to pay attention to this. I mean, I've read that it's supposed to help, so I'm going to try this. So I did, and, you know, as I first started doing it, I would be in a full-blown rage by the time I noticed I was angry. And then it was really painful. It's like, oh, I'm supposed to pay attention to this. And it was hard to be with it, you know. I couldn't do much more than say, oh, I'm angry. And, you know, at some point I could go back to whatever I was doing, working on the computer or taking a walk or whatever. But over the course of months, what happened, and it was months that I did this practice with the anger because it was so strong, I began to see myself waking up. I began to notice that I was angry as opposed to being absorbed in the story and being carried away. I began to notice it earlier and earlier in the process so that I would be, you know, it wouldn't be quite in as much of a rage by the time I woke up. And one day I noticed as I was cutting an apple, I noticed a thought, again, a kind of a sense impression thing related to the apple, a memory with him somewhere. And I could see the inclination of the mind to jump on that thought and become angry. And I saw at that moment that I had a choice. I didn't actually have to follow that thought. I could just let the thought go. And I tried that. I said, wow, that's a thought. And it just disappeared. And I didn't become angry. And that was another kind of mind-blowing experience of, wow, you know, I didn't know that was possible to have a thought about him arise in my mind and not get angry. So it was really, it really began to get that verified faith to have some of these experiences. Now again, the anger didn't disappear completely from my life, but I definitely did see the value of being with it. So I just kept watching it. And over years, it slowly unwound itself to the point now where I basically have a feeling of very deep well-wishing for him. I really want him to be happy. So it's truly amazing, this practice, what it can do for us. So I'd like to suggest some ways that you might practice with this. And mostly, the one thing I really want to suggest is something like what I just described with the anger. Pick some kind of suffering in your life. It doesn't have to be the biggest thing, but pick something that can serve as a kind of a bell that will help you to remember to pay attention to it. Don't just go out thinking, okay, I'm going to try to be mindful or try to understand all the suffering in my life. Just pick something. Pick one thing. It may be restlessness when you read the newspaper in the morning, or a feeling of dissatisfaction when you're driving down the freeway, just something that kind of is regular or recurring in your life. And just pay attention to it. Just notice it. Don't try to do anything with it. Just see what happens when you notice it. And just over the week, is there a change as you notice it, as you keep noticing this same thing over and over again? What do you learn about it as you keep noticing this same type of suffering in your life over and over again? You can also do this in your meditation if you wish. I found it extremely valuable to do this kind of practice in my daily life. It was my main practice at one point in my practice. But you can also do it in your meditation. If you find yourself in a situation in meditation where you're just raging with anger, and there's not much you can do but pay attention to it, I suggest being in your body with it, just trying to see what the physical sensations are. But it can also be really helpful. And I found in my life when I was experiencing very strong emotions, I found that paying attention to the strong emotions and the suffering in my daily life was productive, and giving myself a break in my meditation was productive, and just letting myself rest and have a sense of ease and peace in my resting with the breathing. So that was my approach. But, you know, whatever feels right for you, you know, it's a really intuitive process, this practice. So it's 9 o'clock, but I brought a few, I don't know how much interest there is, a few excerpts. There's not enough for everyone. I didn't think everybody would be interested. But these are sutta references to the topic that we talked about tonight. So if you're interested in what the actual sutta has to say about this topic, you're free to take one of these. And if there's more interest than I have, just let me know that you want one, and I'll bring one next week. So you can take those. And next week, we'll talk about the cause of suffering. Thank you.